I had a privileged childhood because I was born poor. My grandparents emigrated to this country in 1912.
Your grandfather, who was selling fruit on a cart, and he gets arrested one day.
Yes. My grandmother didn't speak English. My grandfather didn't speak English. My grandmother's yelling, "Please, judge, no jail," and she's showing the money. And the Irish judge says, "Her husband is a good man, and he had a bad day, but I'm going to send him home, and I want her to cook him a good meal and be nice to him."
Are you originally from Oklahoma?
No, I'm born in Pakistan and then I grew up there.
What do you miss most about being home?
Food.
The food?
When I was 10, 12 years old, we didn't have hot running water, mm-hmm. and our house was heated by this potbelly stove. My dad put his hand on my shoulder. He was giving me lessons about life, and he said, "Someday you're going to be a lawyer."
Explain what that first moment was like as a judge, that first day for you.
This woman came in. She had three children. She had a terrible attitude. She says, "I just can't pay this fine. I got three kids I can't pay." She was so obstinate that I fined her the full amount. So as soon as court's over, my dad comes in chambers. I said, "Dad, how did I do?" He said, "How did you do? You did terrible." He said, "You fined her the full amount. How do you know she's going to be able to feed her kids tonight? How do you know she can't pay her rent?" Mm. You got to go behind the facts. You can't do that. You got to find out what people are about, what their circumstances are. And he gave me a real tough sermon.
Right.
And it changed my thinking thereafter.
I'm 96 years old and I drive slowly. I was going to the blood work for my boy. He's handicapped.
And he's still, Daddy's still taking care of him, right?
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. So this past week, I drove all the way down from Palm Beach to Miami for this one because I had the incredible honor of sitting down in person with Judge Frank Caprio and his wonderful family. If you don't already know who he is, Judge Caprio is the legendary face of Caught in Providence, the viral courtroom show where his compassion and kindness have touched millions around the world. But beyond his show, he's been a dedicated public servant for decades, and his approach to justice, one rooted in empathy, has made him a true icon. Now he's sharing even more of his wisdom in his new book, Compassion in the Court, where he reflects on his life, his philosophy, and the power of kindness in the legal system. In this episode today, we cover everything from his humble beginnings to his remarkable career, how he's doing now, and his ongoing fight against pancreatic cancer. It was truly a special conversation, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So without further ado, I'm honored to bring you the world's most compassionate judge, Frank Caprio. Judge Caprio, thank you so much for joining me on Misunderstood.
Rachel, it's a pleasure to be here.
So I read your book. I loved your book. It's fantastic. And I can't wait for everyone else to read it. It's a really important book. And I want to ask you about the very first story you have in the book. It talks about your grandparents who immigrated from Italy to Providence, Rhode Island. And it's such an incredible story of their journey and eventually 10 kids and you get into this one story about your grandfather who was selling fruit on a cart and he gets arrested one day.
Yes.
And your mom has to, or your grandmother has to go to court and she's so nervous and she doesn't know what's ahead. And your father goes, am I getting this right? Your father goes to translate?
Yes.
Tell me about that because I know that you had heard that story a lot as a child.
Well, my grandparents emigrated to this country in 1912. Mm-hmm. And there was a massive emigration from Europe to the United States back in those days, people seeking a better life, and that's why they really came here. Mm-hmm. My grandmother had 10 children. My father was the fifth, and he was the first one to arrive in Rhode Island on that journey. Mm-hmm. He was a fruit peddler, and on one particular day, he and his friends, after peddling fruit all day long, decided to have a libation, and they got a little rowdy. And they got arrested. And my grandmother didn't speak English. My grandfather didn't speak English. My dad was about 13 at the time, and he spoke English.
Right.
So my grandmother receives a visit from her friend saying, your husband is in jail. Now, she don't know. She thinks jail. She's thinking of Italy. She thinks he's dead the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, you have to be in court tomorrow to get him out. So she, the first thing that comes to her mind is she needs money to go to the court. So she goes and asks all the fruit peddlers, you know, I need money. My husband's in jail. So she goes to court the following day, and my dad is the interpreter because she don't speak English.
Right.
They bring my grandfather up. He's disheveled. He's been in the cell all night long. Mm-hmm. And with that, my grandmother jumps out of her seat, and she yells, please, judge, no money, no jail. I have the money. And she's got all this money mm-hmm. that the other fruit peddlers gave her. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because back then there were ethnic prejudices. You know, we're talking 1912, back way back then, mm-hmm. and particularly between the Irish and the Italians. And it was an Irish judge. It was white-haired, ruddy-faced Irish judge. Mm-hmm. And they expected the worst, that he's going to go to jail.
Right.
So the Irish judge says to my father, he says, are you going to interpret? He says, yes. So my grandmother's yelling, please, judge, no jail. And she's showing the money. Mm-hmm. And the Irish judge says, young man, tell your mom that his dad is, that her husband is a good man and he had a bad day, but I'm going to send him home and I want her to cook him a good meal and be nice to him.
Right.
And that changed the dynamic. Now, my grandmother had 10 children. That story was a family story about justice, about compassion, you know, and it just, and all of the Irish Italian prejudices in our family disappeared
right.
as a result of that one story.
Right.
But it was a story of compassion and understanding.
Right. And how much compassion and understanding do you think that your father saw growing up? Do you think that was part of his upbringing, or was it a tough upbringing for your father?
Well, it was a double shield. It was that judge, but it was also the prejudices of that day,
mm-hmm.
because there was the most massive immigration in the history of this country around 1912,
right.
1950, actually longer than that, 1920.
Right, right. So you were born in Providence, Rhode Island.
I was.
Tell me about your childhood.
I had a great childhood. I say I had a very privileged childhood, and I mean that in the truest sense of the word. I had a privileged childhood because I was born poor.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people would think that's very tough, not a privilege. Explain that.
But I was born poor, and I appreciated everything in life. Mm-hmm. You know, so Christmas time to me wasn't, boy, I'm going to get a bunch of toys. Mm-hmm. We had love and understanding. We went to Mass together. My father was one of 10. My mother was one of 8. And both families would get together on the holidays, and that was our holidays. It wasn't exchanging expensive gifts. It was a family unit. It was understanding and helping each other.
Right.
And that was my early childhood that I cherish.
So you remember happiness and kindness growing up?
It was full of happiness and kindness.
Yeah.
That was...
yeah.
Both families.
So you're a highly educated person. Talk to me about your education and how you had these opportunities, because you were one of the first that had opportunities like this, right?
When I was probably 10, 12 years old, mm-hmm. we lived in a cold water flat, which means we didn't have hot running water. Mm-hmm. And our house was heated by this potbelly stove. I remember it like it was 10 minutes ago. My dad put his hand on my shoulder. He was giving me lessons about life. And he said to me, someday you're going to be a lawyer.
Did you want to be a lawyer?
After that, I did.
Yeah.
I never entertained the thought.
Right, right.
But I'm only 10, 12 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking of my future occupation. He says, and you can't judge poor people like us.
Right.
I never wanted to be anything else except a lawyer, except I didn't realize that it was fraught with danger, because I had to then actually go to college and law school. I didn't appreciate that when I was 10.
Right.
I thought you just became a lawyer.
Right. You didn't realize how hard it could be to go down that road.
I didn't have the money to go to college, so I worked in a restaurant washing dishes and working the counter.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, it was time to go to law school. And I had been accepted to Boston University School of Law, but I couldn't afford to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I taught school in Providence, Rhode Island, days for 2 years. And then while I was teaching, I went to night law school in Boston and drove to Boston for 4 years, nights, to get my law degree.
Can you talk about the opportunity you got to teach people? How did that come about?
Well, there was a professor at Providence College. Mm-hmm. His name was Father Quinn. Mm-hmm. And he was in charge of the education department. His family actually owned the Boston Braves baseball team.
Oh, wow.
So I figured he's never going to understand my problem. I don't have any money. Mm-hmm. And I went to see Father Quinn and explained my situation to him. He could not have been better. He says, I'm going to make sure you get all of the education requirements so you can teach. He said, but one thing you have to promise me is that you will go to law school. And I'm glad he did that because I had many weak moments along the way.
Right, right. Well, it sounds like a lot of discipline was instilled in you. You had some other jobs when you were younger. I know you helped your dad on the milk truck,
yes.
Right?
Oh,
can you
yeah.
talk about that a little?
Well, I worked on, my dad would wake my brother and I up like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. My brother was 2 years older than I was. Mm-hmm. And we'd say, Dad, you know, he'd say, if you don't want to do this the rest of your life, you make sure you stay in school. So he was a very firm believer in education, mm-hmm. thankfully.
Right.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Amazing. What were some challenges you ran into as you were on your path to get your law degree? Were there times where you thought, oh, I really don't want to do this or I can't do this?
Every time I was driving to Boston. Not really. It was a goal that I had. My father put his hand on my shoulder
right.
and said, someday you're going to be a lawyer. You know, I was discouraged and I was tired,
right.
but I never really thought about quitting. It never entered my mind.
So failure was not an option.
Right.
Right. That's a really important lesson too, right? You talk a lot in the book about just kind of showing up, making sure that you are accountable and you show up for things you're supposed to, because that puts you in the position for your next step. Can you talk about that and how that, you know, what that means to you?
Well, I think your presence is like 95% of the battle.
Mm.
Being there, it's letting people know that you care for them. And that you're firmly interested in their well-being.
Right.
And not your well. So many times people give advice for what's in their best interest. But I've always subscribed to the theory that you want to help the person you're talking to.
Yeah.
And I got that from my father.
Right. What other things did your father teach you?
Well, my father taught me decency, understanding. My father was a milkman. And he would work on his milk truck. And his area that he was in was an immigrant area, and there was a lot of poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And he was ordered by the company that if they didn't pay the milk bill within 2 weeks, he was to stop the milk and not deliver milk. He had his own policy. If they had children, he didn't stop the milk.
Right.
You know, and many times he even would put money from his own pocket to pay a portion of that bill and tell the company they were trying.
Mm.
So it was by his example, you know, that I learned. It wasn't by empty words. You know, so many times parents and others give advice. They're all empty words.
Yeah.
But I had the exemplar right before me with my dad and my mom.
Did you get to witness the appreciation that some of these people had for your father when he did that for them?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. My father was an extremely well-loved man. His name was Tup.
Tell me that story. That's a great story.
Tup of Toffee. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a fruit peddler, and they'd go down to the farmer's market at 5 o'clock in the morning and load up their fruit cart. And on this particular day, it was a little chilly, and my father was minding the cart mm-hmm. while my grandfather was in a restaurant with his friends having coffee. And after a while, my father went into the restaurant because it was cold. And his father says, would you like something? And he says, his face was so frozen that he ordered a tup of toffee. He couldn't say cup of coffee because his face was frozen.
Right.
So from that day on, he was known as Tup or Tup of Toffee.
And everybody called him that.
Everybody called him Tup until the day he died.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. I want to go back to your education for a minute. I must have made your parents, but your father, incredibly proud to see the path you went on. When you finally passed the bar, when you became a lawyer, talk about that moment. What was that like for you?
That was a moment of extreme gratification mm-hmm. because it was from the time that he put his hand on my shoulder besides the potbelly stove. Mm-hmm. You know, and just to digress for a moment, sometimes you don't have to become histrionic or give big sermons to point somebody in life. Sometimes it's just a matter of putting your hand on their shoulder
right,
and giving them some advice that you know comes from the heart. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with me with my dad when he put his hand on my shoulder
right.
and said, someday you'll be a lawyer. And it was a tough road, driving to Boston 4 nights a week, coming mm-hmm. back. But I didn't want to disappoint him. And I didn't want to disappoint myself either.
Right. Did you have an idea of what kind of path you wanted to take? I mean, I know some people are into criminal justice. Some people want to be family and marriage counselors, you know, or lawyers. What was it for you that you really wanted to do when you went through law school?
You know, that's a very good question, because I really wanted to be a lawyer, but I wasn't thinking of specializing, for example, in corporate greed or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be a neighborhood lawyer.
You did.
And I was. Hmm. And I was.
Can you talk about like the first job you had once you got your law degree? What were you doing?
When I graduated from where?
When you graduated and you got your law, when you got your law degree, what were your first jobs after that?
Oh, I had several jobs. I worked for the city as a lawyer for the city. Mm-hmm. I worked for the state prosecuting cases, and I had private practice.
Right. And is there any memory from before you became a judge while you were a lawyer, you know, of a story or what it was like, you know, before you were a judge and before you were the person we know now? You know, what was it like being a lawyer?
Well, I had some very interesting cases, you know. I had an interesting case where a young man came in for a divorce, and he was so distraught because he didn't want the divorce, and he ended up killing his wife.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, I could, like, just give you a litany of cases like that. We ended up trying him for murder. You know, and he was found not guilty by reason of insanity.
Hmm.
So he actually spent 15 years in jail. They let him out.
Oh, wow. Wow. So did you like doing private practice?
Did I what?
Did you like doing private practice? Did you like doing cases
like that? I love private
like
practice.
That? Yeah?
Yes, I love private practice. It's a one-on-one situation. You know, when you're dealing with real issues, real people, you're not dealing with corporate America.
Right.
You're not dealing with a big checkbook. Half the people that came in couldn't afford it for my neighborhood.
Right.
Anyway, they come in and they came in and said, Frankie.
Right.
As soon as they said Frankie, I knew I couldn't charge them.
Right. So talk to me about how you became appointed a judge. Do you remember that story?
I do. As a matter of fact, it was because of a dear friend of mine who was the mayor at the time. Mm-hmm. His name was Joe Paolino. Mm-hmm. And Joe was a former president of the city council and member of the city council from the district in which I lived. And I knew him, and he was very talented. And I helped him in his campaign. And he called me one day and said, we have a vacancy on the Providence Municipal Court. And the vacancy is created and appointed by the Providence City Council, not by the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was fortunate that Joe was able to use his influence with the city council and his recommendation for me to be a judge. And that's how it all happened, and I've never forgotten it.
So for you, did you have to hesitate, or were you like, yes, this is what I want to do next? Did you have to hesitate when he asked you, or were you like,
oh, no,
yes?
I didn't hesitate at all. Yeah. No, that was a dream come true.
Right. So before we started seeing you on TV as a judge, explain what that first moment was like as a judge, that first day for you behind the bench.
First day, you know, I'm all full of myself now. I'm a judge, and I have the robe, and I'm the boss, and I'm up there, and this woman came in. She had three children, and she had a terrible attitude. And I said, she says, I just can't pay this fine. I got three kids I can't pay, and I don't care what you do. And I was a little rough with her, you know. So finally, she was so obstinate that I fined her the full amount, which she couldn't pay, so I put her on a payment plan.
Right.
And my dad was at the court because it was my first day, and he wanted to see his son on the bench the first day. Mm-hmm. So as soon as court's over, my dad comes in chambers. I said, Dad, how did I do? You know, I feel great now. He said, how did you do? You did terrible. I said, I did terrible. He said, that woman. I said, what woman? He said, the woman who had the three kids. He said, you fined her the full amount. How do you know if she's going to be able to feed her kids tonight? How do you know if she can't pay her rent? Mm. You got to go behind the facts. He says, you can't do that. You got to find out what people are about, what their circumstances are. And he gave me a real tough sermon.
Right.
And it changed my thinking thereafter.
So does that mean, like, literally the next day you went on the bench and you listened to cases, you started to really think about their experience and their human experience and if they deserved a second chance or...
Absolutely, yeah. Because of my dad.
Yeah, amazing. A lot of things because of your dad, right?
Basic unit of society, the family unit.
Yeah. You know I love a good glow up, but let's talk about a real game changer for your daily routine. That's Amazfit. What if your smartwatch can do more than just track steps? What if it actually helped you live better, move smarter, and feel amazing? I have such a great product for you guys. I'm so excited to tell you about it. Amazfit isn't just a smartwatch. It's your personal wellness coach with advanced fitness tracking, 24/7 heart rate monitoring, and even stress management tools. It keeps you connected to your health in real time. Whether you're crushing a workout, managing a busy schedule, or just trying to get better sleep, Amazfit has your back. It has 160 plus workout modes from swimming to running, advanced sleep monitoring. It literally has everything. You will never get bored. You will never find something that it doesn't have. I'm really obsessed with it. I've been using it, and let me tell you, it's sleek and stylish. I wear it every day. I wear it every night. It's super comfortable. It lasts up to 10 days on a single charge. No more stressing over dead batteries midday. Plus, with built-in Alexa and tons of sports modes, it's like having a personal trainer on your wrist. The Zepp app has made tracking my fitness, calories, and even sleeping better. So if you're ready to take your fitness and wellness to the next level, check out Amazfit. Head to amazfit.com/understood to grab yours today and start living smarter with a 10% off discount. Again, it's amazfit.com/understood for 10% off. You know, for years, they've told us how to manage our health, mandates, restrictions, all of it. And now when we try to take control for ourselves, they push back. No thanks. That's why I'm making my health a priority with Field of Greens. Let's be real. Eating healthy is key to staying healthy, but life gets busy. Sticking to a perfect diet every day, not always possible. That's where Field of Greens comes in. It's real whole fruits and vegetables, doctor selected for specific health benefits, heart, lungs, metabolism, even healthy weight support. One drink and I'm getting a head start on my day. I've never been a fan of plain water. It's just so bland. But mixing Field of Greens into my daily routine has changed that. The wild berry and strawberry lemonade flavors are my personal favorites. They add a delicious twist that makes drinking water enjoyable and helps me stay hydrated throughout the day. Plus, I've recently added their Radiance Collagen Peptides to my regimen. It's another new favorite of mine, supporting healthy skin, hair, and nails. I feel the difference, more energy, better gut health, just overall better. And Field of Greens promises that at your next checkup, your doctor will notice too, or your money back. Can you believe that? Take control of your health today. Go to fieldofgreens.com and use code UNDERSTOOD for 20% off. That's fieldofgreens.com. Use code UNDERSTOOD for 20% off. I cannot wait to hear how you feel. So how long was it before you started filming that you were behind the bench for 38 years? Did I get that right? So somehow in there, you guys got the smart idea to start filming it. We'll get into that in a minute. But how many years were you a judge before you started filming?
I was a judge 20 years, about 20 years before we even started filming.
Right.
And I have a younger brother who was a traffic engineer, but for some reason he wanted to be a videographer. So he came to see me to help him buy some cameras to be a videographer because he thought he could film all these events because the state of Rhode Island had a public access station. They had just formed a public access station.
Right.
And he was able to secure 2 hours a day on public access.
Right.
And there was such competition for it. He felt so proud of himself.
Right.
I have 2 hours a day on public access.
That's a lot of time back then. Yeah.
The problem was he didn't have the content to put on.
Mm-hmm.
So he was befuddled. And my wife suggested, why don't you film your brother's court program?
And what was your reaction?
My reaction was absolutely not. I don't want him in the courtroom. Well, you know who won that argument.
Right, exactly. So do you remember what that was like, having a camera and your brother in the court at the beginning? Did you not even notice?
It started off just being local in Providence, Rhode Island. And it actually ignited. It was on at like 2 o'clock in the morning and midnight.
Right.
And people would call in, and there was a number you could call in. People would call in, and they'd argue with each other. And if I gave somebody a break, they say he's too lenient. And if I didn't give him a break, they say, you know, he's not lenient enough.
Right.
And so it was quite a success.
So was this the first time that you started hearing people's opinions that sort of didn't matter, but people on the outside, they were leaving all these messages saying they liked it, they didn't like it? Or did you know how people felt about the way that you ruled behind the bench
There was great reaction. Rhode Island's a very small state, you know, and we're very close-knit. But the reaction was that at night, everyone would watch it, and they'd deliberately call in and say some terrible things about me because they knew that someone would then call in and defend me. So it was the defense and the prosecutors.
Right. Interesting. So that happened for many years, I hear, that you were on public access, and then local TV, and then you started Facebook Watch. And that's kind of where it blew up, right? And people started to really see that this was something and people really liked it. And then it became syndicated.
Yes.
Right. So what did you think? Like, why do you think this had such traction? Why do you think people loved it so much?
I think because we dealt with the human element. I think I think it was how I handled people who came before the court.
Yeah.
I always subscribe to the theory that there was always a story behind the story. You know, someone may perform a particular act because there's something in their life. They may be unemployed. They may have 5 children. Maybe they can't eat that night. Maybe they lost their house to foreclosure. You never know what the issues were or are in people's lives.
Right.
And I always tried to probe before I made a decision to find out what they were.
Right. So you picked a number of really good stories for your book. How did you decide how to narrow it down to just the stories you put in the book?
Because
I'm sure there was so many stories to add in the book. Did you pick the ones that you
It was very difficult because every day I'm hearing, why didn't you tell this story or why didn't you tell that one? I may have to write another book.
Yeah, exactly. So can you tell our listeners some of the stories that stood out the most to you of someone who you remember what that was like?
Well, I had Victor Coella. He came in. He was 96 years old. He was taking his son for chemo treatment, and he got caught for speeding. And we helped Victor out, became very friendly with him. He actually baked me an apple pie. It was the best apple pie I had. And he lived to be 102, but we kept a very close relationship with Victor and several others. There was a young man who was autistic, you know, and we followed through with he and his family and helped him out. There were several instances where we went above and beyond just the court situation and had a personal relationship with people who came before the court.
There was one case that I watched. I think it was on your social media where it was a young man maybe in his 20s, and he had to walk maybe 5 miles to come to court one day. And it really brought me to tears because you could see the moment in his face and in his demeanor where he didn't expect you to be lenient and he couldn't even pay the fine because he couldn't, you know, he didn't have bus transportation to get back. And it was just the most incredible story. And that's when I first started to see that you were, to see how different you were as a judge, because you really looked at someone who probably has felt misunderstood much of their lives, which is probably how they ended up in your corner.
Yeah. He walked from East Providence to Providence, about 5 miles.
Yeah.
No, so you listen to stories when someone's obviously lying to you or they'll make something up, you know, and someone comes in like that and you say he has such a respect for the institutions of government that he actually walked 5 miles and came in. And he didn't make a big deal about it either.
Yeah, right. Was there anyone that it was very difficult to be kind to because they were so disrespectful or they didn't care?
Quite a few.
So how did you handle them?
Each case is different. Mm-hmm. By the time they finish, you know, usually it would be on the arraignment. I'd have them come back for a trial. And then at the trial, at the end of the trial, they'd be a different person.
Right, right. Are there any stories that to this day, and I don't mean the stories of what happened in the courtroom, but the person themselves that you remember and it really bothered you, either their circumstance or something that you really remember and you wonder how they are now?
Well, I have some good ones.
Okay.
You know, I have a fellow come in, oh, I don't know, a few years back, and he was what he referred to himself as a bad boy. Mm-hmm. And then he came back. I forget what I did on the disposition. I gave him a break, I think. Mm-hmm. And then he came back last year, and he had a parking ticket. And I said, what are you doing here for a parking ticket? And he started to cry, and he was a rough guy. Mm-hmm. He owned a truck business now. And he says, I never forget when I came here 5 years ago. He says, you said to me, what do you want to do in life? You want to go to jail? You want to be dead? You know, or you want to be a good boy? Mm-hmm. Or you want to be somebody? He says, and I made a decision then. I want to be somebody. And with that, he reached in his pocket and he took out his driver's license. He says, see, I got a driver's license now, and I'm working, and I'm driving a truck, and so forth. And that really warmed my heart. That just, you know, sometimes it's just like a little suggestion that can change somebody's life.
Right.
It's not usually an upheaval.
Right. Yeah. It's just that little bit. And also somebody taking a moment to really understand who they are, which is what they saw in you.
The fact that you care. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can change somebody's life, not by yelling at them and screaming at them or giving them a sermon or trying to send them someplace for advice, by putting your hand on their shoulder
and
telling them that you care,
right?
That you really care.
So how has this felt to see how big you've gotten from social media and your show? What is that like to now be somebody who's Emmys?
All social media, we have 25 million views. Mm-hmm. Hasn't changed me at all. You know, I'm grateful. I think it's all because of my upbringing. I think it's because of the lessons that I learned at my father's knee of understanding. I learned it by example of compassion and understanding, I remember my father always saying, if you can help somebody, help them. If you can help them, help them.
Right.
And that sort of permeated that family unit.
Your courtroom is so different because of the compassion that you show to the people coming through there. Do you ever watch these other shows that are on TV,
no.
Like Hot Bench or Judge Judy when it was on, those kind of things?
No, the difference is that we are an actual court proceeding, and they are stage productions.
Right.
So they're all predetermined. You know, right. So I've seen them, and I have respect for Judge Judy. Mm-hmm. I think she does a great job. She's, as far as court judges are concerned, she's the star.
Right. What do you think of, you know, the fact that your brother came up with this idea basically to film, and then how long did he film in the court with you? Decades, right?
He filmed, I think 20 years.
Yeah. Pretty good idea he came up with, right? I guess after all that.
What was my wife's idea?
Right. So they were pretty smart to do that.
It worked out well for everyone.
It worked out well.
Yes.
It worked out well. So even though you've been out of the court for a couple years, you guys are still on the air. People are still seeing what you do. Talk to us about what you've been doing the last couple years.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
the last couple years, what have you been doing since you've been off air? But, you know, we still see you on air, but what have you been doing? You're spending a lot of time with family.
Well, I've been spending a lot of time with family. We're doing a lot of interviews, mm-hmm. a lot of podcasts, and a lot of exposure.
Right. Now, we all know we've been following along with you on your health journey. How are you feeling?
Well, it's a long road. Mm-hmm. I'm still battling. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for results. You know, could be a lot better.
Right. Well, you've been dealing with this for a year and a half, almost 2 years, right? And you're fighting. You look great. You got some of your hair back.
I'm not giving up. You're not giving up.
Yeah. And you've been walking. You're staying fit. I see you in the gym.
I go to the gym for a short period of time. I make sure I walk every single day. I'm trying to keep my strength up. I think it'll help with my other issue of having pancreatic cancer. So
Right. So. And I see from being an outsider and looking into your social media that your family is still number one. You're surrounded by your family all the time.
Always.
Yeah. And talk about now how big your family has become. You have all these people around you. So who are you always with?
I'm always with my kids. Mm-hmm. my brother, of course, films the program. My son David and my son Frank are intimately involved in it as well. So it's a collaborative deal.
Right. And what keeps you motivated? What do you want to do next? Is there something on your bucket list that you still want to accomplish?
I want to get a good result from pancreatic cancer. That's my focus right now.
Yep. Do you think you have another book in you?
After the response to this one, I think I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, it's number one right now, I think.
Because I'm now thinking, you know, gee, I left all this stuff out that I really didn't think that was important.
Right.
But I'm learning that people are interested.
Yeah, they seem very interested.
So we might have number two coming out, I'm not sure.
Okay, good. What, from writing this first book, first of all, how long did it take you? Not long. Okay,
no.
Did you love doing it?
I did it all myself, really, you know, and just took me 5 weeks, I think.
Wow.
Not that long.
Wow. So all those memories were right there and you just wanted to get them out, which
is
great.
Get them out while they were still fresh.
Yeah. And what do you want the takeaway from people reading this to be about the book?
I want to take into consideration the person that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Understand their situation and show some compassion and understanding. All too often, you know, we take a slant on something and we won't change our mind. But I think sometimes if you probe, you find out why people are acting in a particular way. And if you find out the reason, I think you may change your mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good lesson because I think people forget that when they run into somebody, that person may have 1,000 things going on in their mind, in their life that you just don't know about. And if you just lead with kindness, it can really help that person. You have no idea what they're going through. You know,
an example of that is a woman came before me and she had $500 worth of parking tickets. And I was grilling her, you know, why didn't you pay him? And why didn't you do this? And then all of a sudden she broke into tears and she said, if only I was there, it never would have happened. If only I was there, it never would have happened. And I says, what are you talking about? She said, my brother killed my son. Mm. They had an argument. And if I was there, it never would have happened. And she says, and so my life is topsy-turvy and so forth. And of course, I gave her a monster break because of the problem she was going through. But you never know that unless you probe.
Right. I have a question. If you had not taken the path you did, if your father had never put his hand on your shoulder and said, I want you to be a lawyer, or you're going to be one, if you had never been a judge, what do you think you would have done with your life?
I don't know. Most of the kids in my neighborhood had menial jobs. You know, they worked for the city, the highway department, or the traffic engineer department, or they worked in jewelry shops. But my father was such a strong believer in education that thankfully he put his hand on my shoulder.
Yeah.
I should write a book, Hand on Your Shoulder.
That would be a great title. What do you want people listening to this to know about your legacy? How should they always remember you as they watch your life story? What do you want to be known for?
I just want to be known for being understanding and compassionate. It's that simple, nothing else.
Right. It's such a difficult time in the world right now. So many people live very angry lives.
And helping people if I can.
Yeah. And do you have a message for anyone listening that's having a really hard time that, you know, feels lonely, feels misunderstood? What would be your message to someone like that?
I'd say, well, there's two messages. One, I pray. I'm a strong believer in prayer. Mm. The other is I would seek good friends and get advice that's in your best interest and not in theirs.
Yeah, that's great advice. Your book is available anywhere you can get books?
Any place they sell books, you can buy Compassion in the Court.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining me. I wish you the best.
Rachel, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
It's been an honor. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.